people who lined us all up, recruited me and everybody else along. This is Stephanie and Emma. And so I think we should give them all a round of applause.
Sounds good. All right, so I'd like everybody else to begin by thanking Rob, Mark, and Gifre for putting together this really wonderful workshop. It's been quite fantastic and stimulating this week. And I'd like to tell you about some stuff that I've been thinking about for the past year or so. Primarily thanks to my student, Massimiliano Rota, who convinced me to think about this topic. I think he deserves a lot of credit for much of the work that was done. So I'll report on a couple of papers that we wrote together and also a paper that we wrote with Eric Perlmutter earlier this summer. And I want to begin by sort of reflecting a little bit upon some of the themes we've heard over this week. And at least if not, posing a set of questions which was sort of motivating us to think about this set of ideas. Not that I will have any specific answers for you with regard to these questions, but I think these questions are worth keeping in mind as we go along trying to develop better models of how quantum gravity works in line with quantum information. So the general theme we've seen sort of emerge in the last few years is that there's an intrinsic connection between entanglement and holography. And you may ask whether the title of the conference should have been Quantum Information in Quantum Gravity or Quantum Information is Quantum Gravity. And to some extent, we sort of seem to think that quantum information is quantum gravity, though, and there's sort of some evidence towards this emerging from various different directions. But a question that I'd like to pose is, do we care what kind of quantum information? In other words, when we say entanglement here, does quantum gravity care whether this entanglement is EPR type? And here I have a particular concept in mind. That is, can you use this to perform a Bell type experiment to see a violation of some Bell or generalized Bell-like inequality? I don't know the answer, but it's something worth keeping in mind. It's certainly something that we assume in holography. We sort of assume that it's an EPR type bipartite entanglement that we sort of care about when we say ER equals EPR or space-time emerges from entanglement. Would things change if this entanglement structure were there, but so-called undistillable? That is, the state has, the wave function of the quantum field theory has some intrinsic entanglement built in, but it's not something that you can extract in terms of, you can't perform some experiment on this quantum state and extract a Bell pair from it. Does it matter? Does it matter if the entanglement is not purely quantum, but contaminated with classical correlations? And finally, do we really care whether the entanglement is bipartite, or could there be emergent space-time coming from multi-party entanglement? Can entanglement be multipartite? Or does multipartite entanglement lead to geometry? Or can it lead to geometry, or does it preclude geometry? We have some partial hints for various of these things, but operationally, when we sort of try to go from entanglement to holography, we only seem to take bipartitions of some state or some density matrix and compute inspired by RT entanglement entropy and use that as a proxy for how much entanglement how geometry can emerge. A second set of questions that I find quite interesting is whether what kind of constraints are to be imposed on the quantum entanglement. We heard from Matt on Monday what is special about holographic entanglement entropy. Maybe thinking about flow lines tells us something about what holographic entanglement holographic entanglement entropy is characteristic of, but is there something we can sort of build into ground wave functions in holographic context and ask if we have systems which have this kind of class of entanglement, are they guaranteed to be holographic? We also heard on, I guess, Tuesday or Wednesday from Ning Bao about the holographic entanglement entropy cone, what the constraints that these guys have derived in the context of asking what is the general set of inequalities that that holographic entanglement entropy satisfies. A related question, are both of these questions are tied to the notion of entanglement entropy, but you could ask the question, are there alternate measures of entanglement which provide some intuition of how holography can work? And again, we've heard over the week various attempts to come up with proposals and ideas of how other measures of quantum entanglement can be encoded holographically. We heard today of two ideas in relating to complexity in the morning and how the relative entropy and various notions involving information matrix play a role in holography. And we heard earlier a similar story from Tadashi on Monday. At this point, I want to sort of pose a sort of philosophical question to which I don't know an answer, but I think it's another thing worth keeping in mind as we try to chart out this terrain of entanglement and quantum gravity. That is, should every quantum information theoretic notion of entanglement or entanglement witness have a geometric dual. My tentative answer is no, or at least I don't see a strong reason why, but it's something worth keeping in mind as we go along. So this is a set of questions that sort of motivated us to start thinking about other measures of quantum information, and in particular whether we could try to use some measure that is if you like, cognizant of a distinction between classical correlations and quantum intrinsic quantum entanglement, and whether one could use that as a proxy for how holography works. Okay, so I'm going to do two things. I'm going to first try to define for you this measure that that Giffrey and Werner introduced in 2001. So it's called entanglement negativity. I'll tell you why it was introduced and what it's useful for. And I'll try to give you a feeling for how this quantity works in quantum field theory, what we can do with it, and then sort of turn things around and try to work in a very, very simple toy model. It's a toy model that's even simpler than some of the more complicated tensor networks that we've sort of seen over the week, a toy model involving a few qubits, and try to play games with few qubits and ask when are few qubit systems sort of do they capture features that are holographic? Okay, so that's roughly the plan. In fact, you will see no geometry, no space time, nothing. I'm not going to do any holographic calculations. Calculations are going to be either quantum field theoretic or qubits. In fact, I won't do calculations. I'll just tell you some results. But I'll at various points tell you what are the similarities of this with structures we've seen in holography, or try to sort of look for constraints that we've seen in holographic systems and how these things fit with that picture. Okay, so that's the general idea. So the focus, try to distinguish classical correlations from pure quantum entanglement using entanglement negativity. So that explains three out of the four words in the talk. Fourth one will sort of become clear as we go along. Okay. So let me try to define this object for you and then tell you where it came from, why people were interested in this, and what is it that we've learned since it was introduced in 2001. So let's say we have a bipartite system. And let me write it as a tensor product Hilbert spaces, H left tensor, H right. And let's say we have a density matrix. Whose matrix elements in some obvious basis of these two Hilbert spaces, which I will call RA and L alpha, A labels states in R and alpha labels states in L. So we can compute the density matrix elements of this density matrix in this particular but conveniently chosen basis. So given this density matrix, I'll make one manipulation on it, which a priori sounds strange, and then I'll tell you why this operation was done. So let me define the partial transpose of this matrix, of this density matrix, to be such that I transpose with respect to one of the two Hilbert spaces. I transpose with respect to the left Hilbert space, say. So the matrix elements of rho gamma is the same as that of rho, but with the second set of indices swapped. Okay. So if you have the density matrix and other matrix elements, you can certainly construct this object. And given this, we define two measures of entanglement which are sort of related. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to measure the trace norm of rho gamma and call n of the density matrix. So the measure I'm going to define, measure some property of the original density matrix, but the computation is going to involve this auxiliary object I introduce here. So I take the trace norm of this operator rho gamma, subtract 1 and divide by 2, and call this the negativity as Vidal and Werner did in their paper from 2001. Alternately, I could take slightly more in a manner that's a bit more reminiscent of entanglement entropy, the log of the trace norm of the partial transpose matrix and call that the logarithmic negativity. So there's sort of two notions that are used in literature. They're obviously related, of course, but we'll find that this guy has certain nicer properties for qubit systems, whereas this guy is a bit nicer when you want to talk about continuum systems. So at this point, it sort of sounds like something that came out of left field. Why did we just pull this one out of a hat? And historically, I think the idea of partial transpose goes back almost 2 decades to understanding. So this operation of is useful to talk about separability of density matrices. We all know what separability of a state means. If you can't write if you're given a state, you can look at it and say whether the state is separable or not. But if I give you a mixture of density matrices, when is the density matrix non-separable? A separable density matrix is one if it can be written as a linear, as a convex sum of unentangled density matrices with normalized coefficients. And a result that dates back 2 decades says that a separable density matrix has positive partial trace. And this trace norm, roughly speaking, counts the departure from this matrix being positive partial trace. Okay. So negativity is basically saying that if you take the partial transpose, the if your matrix, if your density matrix has non-zero negativity, it means that it's not separable. These are density matrices themselves. That's right. These guys have no entanglement, the row eyes. Yeah. Now, this part is straightforward, but the converse is not true. And there were various conjectures that people here can correct me. And what has been shown is that if rho is PPT, then rho is undistillable. But it doesn't mean that it's not entangled, okay? Because there is some entanglement built into rho. You just can't access it by any operation. Now, you might think that undistillable density matrices are nice because you can, they would violate some kind of Bell inequality. That also turns out to be not true, but there's a question. That's my understanding. Maybe people here can see. So, you know, this idea was introduced by Perez in 95, and since then people have tried to come up with various increasing levels of sophistication of what are sort of trying to characterize states that are intrinsically quantum. To my knowledge, there's no clean separation of states that violate Bell inequalities in any given quantum system. You sort of look at the space of states, there's some, if you look at mixtures like this, there are things that work, there are unidirectional implications that work, but there is no very clean demarcation of the space of density matrices into states that you can say, these are great, I can use this to perform some Bell-like experiment and see violation of a Bell inequality. We don't have a completely good characterization. But nevertheless, this object has been proven useful. And with Alan Werner introduced this in their notion as a, as they called it in the title of their paper, a computable measure of entanglement. Now, this is certainly true for discrete systems. As I'll try to mention later, it's interesting to try to compute this in continuum quantum field theories. It's a reasonably hard problem, I would say. Slightly harder than computing entanglement entropy, for reasons you will see in a moment. So that's the object I want to talk about. So I want to talk about these negativities. One useful fact, which I'll mention here, that the negativity itself gives a measure of the robustness of entanglement inherent in the state. So the idea here is you take your density matrix. And add some noise to it. Through some separable density matrix. And such that the new density matrix you get, which is rho plus some amount of separable density matrix you add, if this guy becomes separable itself, you ask for how much of rho s do I need to add to rho to make rho tilde separable. So this gives a measure of amount of noise. and the robustness you can define. Is the minimum S scanned over all choices of separable density matrices you can throw into your system, all noise realizations you can throw into your system to disrupt the entanglement. The smallest amount of noise you can throw in that would disrupt the entanglement tells you what robustness is. And what is known is that this guy is twice n of rho. I'm not entirely sure, someone can correct me, if this is a theorem or if this is an expectation. Sorry, yes, you're right. So this is for starting with, yes, this is not for mixtures. You're right. It's a result, okay. Is anything known for mixed states? Okay. So I'm going to sort of use this as a proxy for something we would like to try to compute in a class of theories, and see what we get. Okay. And I'll later tell you some useful facts that come out from qubit experiments that seem interesting and at least promising to pursue further. So before I go on, let me say one thing. So given rho acting on this enlarged in this and this bipartition, we can of course also trace out one half. Yes. I don't have a good intuitive picture to sort of give you a state at hand. I can tell you quantum systems later if you like, which would sort of seems to do the job of that kind. We can also trace out one component and define the reduced density matrix of the other. And then what I will do in much of the discussion is consider either the negativity normalized with respect to this, with the entanglement for this reduced density matrix rho r, or the logarithmic negativity when I talk about the continuum systems normalized with respect to SR. Okay. When I do qubit systems, I'll be doing pure states, so it'll be without loss of generality whether I use SR or S left. Actually, even for continuum systems, I'll talk mostly about pure states because that's what I know how to compute. And so this normalization with respect to SR, I will use as a proxy to remove, to be able to compare across theories. If I'm comparing theories with vastly different degrees of freedom, this normalization takes out all the species dependent. So this is a number that depends on the theory, not on how many components I have in the theory. If I was doing SUN super young males with n equals 2 versus n equals 25, this number doesn't care about that. All right? So let's try to do one simple calculation to give you some feeling for what this object is. So let's first compute the logarithmic negativity for a pure state. And let's take everybody's favorite pure state in holography, which is the Hartle-Hawking state, the thermophile double state, which is by notation of left, right is suggestive. So take the state. it's a simple exercise to compute the matrix elements of, so you can compute rho. And from that, compute the matrix elements of the partial transport object. And two-line calculation to see that the logarithmic negativity of this Hartle-Hawking state ends up being a combination of two guys. It's a ratio of the partition function of the theory at temperature beta over 2 squared normalized by the partition function of the theory at temperature, inverse temperature beta, which is, of course, nothing but the difference of the free energies at temperature T and 2T. No, because the free energies have a, the free energy has a beta over 2. So I checked that. So this is an easy calculation to do, but those of you who have played around with trying to compute entanglement entropy will immediately recognize this, which is actually indicative of the general answer. For pure rho, E rho is the same as S half of rho r. That is, the logarithmic negativity for the global pure state is the same as the Rényi entropy at index half for the reduced density matrix obtained by tracing out one of the components, which is basically what this result is telling you. The fact that you get the free energy at temperature 2T is the statement that you're getting the Rényi at index half. Okay, so this observation was first made by Calabresi, Cardi, and Tony when they were trying to learn how to compute negativity in conformal field theories in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And the calculation is very similar to the calculation you would do for entanglement entropy using the replica trick. With one change from usual entanglement entropy calculation, the partial transpose it involves one swap of twist and anti-twist operators. Yes. Oh yes. I didn't mean to say it's only true for field theory. It's quite general. They employed it in the context of trying to do kind of analytic continuations by computing even Rényis.
But for pure states, this quantity can be an analytical expression.
I agree. Yes. Right. I think the calculation, my intuitive calculation for pure states, basically uses this kind of logic. And then what you say is true. You just go to the Schmidt basis, and then you would see immediately that it's always rho half SF. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples of this computation just for fun. So if you do this computation in 2D CFTs, if you take one interval, E of the vacuum is C over 2 log L over epsilon, which the only difference being from usual entanglement entropy is the factor here. It's 1/2 and not 1/3. Yes? On every sheet, right? When I have twist, so if I do one interval of like this calculation, I do one swap, it doesn't make a change. Because I have a twist and anti-twist. I have twist at one end of the interval, anti-twist at the other end of the interval. So it's just a two-point function. If I have two disconnected intervals, then it's one calculation would involve twist, anti-twist, twist, anti-twist. That's the usual computation. This calculation will involve twist, anti-twist, anti-twist, twist. Okay. So this makes a difference when you try to do, for example, if you try to do conformal blocks, this OPE is tricky. So there's one OPE channel which is tricky. But some people have done this, Policastro, Parnachev, and Kulaksizi tried doing this last year for some cases. And the CFT calculations have been done for small central charges, and spin chains have been done by various combinations of Calabresi, Cardi, and Tony. It's actually fun to try to, this is an easy calculation, but we can also do higher dimensional CFTs for spherical regions. Because we know the trick that Horacio, Rob, and Marina taught us of mapping the spherical region entanglement entropy or any entropy computation to computation of some partition function on hyperbolic space. So I will just quote for you some results. So let me quote the result for you for this object, what I will call X, which is E over S, for a couple of different theories, which I find quite amusing. Now, if I'm doing this in a continuum, both the entanglement entropy and the negativity are divergent, and they have an area law divergence. The entanglement entropy has a usual area law divergence, and then has a subleading terms, and there's some finite piece or a logarithmic piece down in the bottom. Likewise, the negativity, which starts out its life as Reni half, has an area law divergence with a different coefficient, and then also goes down to some finite piece. So I could take this ratio, but this ratio will only care about the Reni index, so it will be some simple answer. Let me instead try to talk about a normalized answer, which is the coefficient of the universal part of logarithmic negativity to the universal part of entanglement. By which, for doing this computation, I'm imagining that I'm doing the same, I have the same regulation scheme. I'm throwing away all the regulator pieces and keeping the universal part of the scheme independent, and then taking the ratio. All right, so what do we get? Good. Very good. So for the moment, I actually don't know. But for one, I also don't know whether this guy, the logarithmic negativity, has an interpretation in terms of robustness. Okay. You will see there's a peculiarity here. So hang on to that question for a second. That was one of the questions I was going to pose. So first of all, you can compute this for free theories. So this is some. So let me not draw this plot just yet. So this ratio is some number, which is not very material. But I know how to do the computation in two different regimes, or rather, people have done the computations in these two different regimes, and we can take over the results. So for three-dimensional scalars, you get some number here. This is for scalars. And if you take the same result and extrapolate, and you take the sort of corresponding answer in the holographic theory, you get a decrease in this ratio. This ratio monotonically decreases as a function of coupling. The nicest case I know of is to do the calculation for free n equals 4 Supiang-Mills, where this ratio at free, in the free limit, gets reduced by 2% as you go to strong coupling. Which is rather peculiar. This first line, you are worried about what is the holographic computation of strong coupling for a free scalar. I had some theory of that kind in mind. So I was just trying to, since this is normalized, I was computing the answer for one scalar degree of freedom versus some ADS4 computation. And then, this is per degree of freedom. So you can ask how many degrees of freedom are there in the strongly coupled theory. What is the relative ratio? In n equals 4 case, you can do the full computation in both ends. So I should have said here something which is quite important. So these were for the vacuum state of a CFT partitioned across a spherical ball. Now you might ask, can I do this computation for other domains in continuum quantum field theories? And this would be relevant to answer Aitor's question, is this quantity some interesting quantity to consider? Because we have sort of thrown away the divergent pieces and kept just the universal piece. So in the paper with Eric and Max from the summer, we were able to do this in four-dimensional CFTs for arbitrary entangling surfaces. So you take a four-dimensional CFT. A spatial section of it is a three surface. So if I decompose that three surface, the three geometry into inside and outside of some surface, that surface is a two surface. And let's say this is a compact two surface, so it's characterized by its genus. So you can ask, as a function of topology and the geometry of this entangling surface, what happens to this ratio? To do that, we need some results, which thankfully we have from Aitor and Eric's work, generalizing some work that was done by Solodukin a few years ago. So let me write the partitioning across some genus G Riemann surface. So what I have in mind is this is region A. Very good. So I'll tell you all the shape dependence in a second. Let's say this is embedded in S3 for simplicity. So it's a CFT on S3 cross R. I've taken a time slice. I've drawn some region A on it embedded in S3, and I have a Riemann surface sitting there. What we know is the following, as Horacio says, the Qth Reni entropy depends on three pieces of data. It depends on the intrinsic geometry of the surface with some coefficient, which I will call FA, which is a function of the Reni index. It depends on how this surface is embedded in the S3, so it cares about how the surface is sort of wobbling around in the S3, so it cares about the extrinsic curvatures of the surface in S3. And there's one more term for general three geometries, which depends on the pullback of the Weyl tensor onto the surface. So these are all integrated quantities. These are completely geometric. There's completely geometric data here. But these functions, FA, FB, and FC, are functions of the Reni index. And the central charges of the theory. Which I will call A and C. There are two central charges in four dimensions. They're functions of these two objects. Now, what Aitar and Eric showed is how to relate this coefficient to this coefficient. They gave an explicit derivation of how to relate this coefficient to the in terms of this coefficient, and provided the evidence, which was then substantiated in the previous in an unpublished work by Ji Dong, that these two coefficients are the same for any conformal field theory. So in other words, if you know this coefficient, the coefficient of the which captures the geometric information, how the intrinsic geometric information, then you know the dependence of the Reni entropies for all Q, for any geometry, and this one can be obtained from spherical partitioning.
But A and C are independent. Right?
They're independent. So, but the functions are known. The functional form in terms of So FC is known in terms of FA, FB is known in terms of FA, actually FA and its derivatives. That's function of Q.
But this is
now, this relation is universal. This was derived in perturbation theory by Reni perturbation theory by Aitor and Eric. This conjecture is known to be true in free fields and holography, but there's some hope that this is more general, but nobody has derived it yet. More generally, there's no proof that FB equals FC. What you can show is the following, that this ratio is some combination of these functions and geometric data. So just the universal pieces again. That this ratio can be less than unity if dA is of, let me be vague here in interest of time, of sufficiently high genus. In theories with A greater than C. And the logic is very simple. as you ramp up the genus, the curvature contribution only cares about the genus. So two surface, so the integral of the intrinsic curvature on a two surface by Gauss-Bonnet theorem is just the is just given in terms of genus. So the higher the genus, the more negative this term. There exist surfaces of arbitrarily high genus for which the trace of the extrinsic curvature contribution can be bounded and bounded by positive number independent of genus. So this is a famous conjecture in mathematics that goes back to Willmore in the 65 and generalized by Lawson for higher genus surfaces. So you can argue that theories with A greater than C, this ratio ceases to have intrinsic quantum information theoretic meaning, because in quantum, what I didn't tell you is that the robustness or negativity is only a lower, is an upper bound of entanglement. Negativity and entanglement, because it's like Reni at half is generically bigger than the entanglement entropy for the same region. Okay, so the fact that this ratio is less than unity for this class of theories suggests that there's something funny going on if you try to interpret this ratio in terms of a robustness quantity for quantum information. It should be borne in mind, however, that theory, conformal field theory with A greater than C are somewhat funny. We don't have very many examples, and most holographic theories tend to have A less than C, even if you sort of, and A less than C is much more stable from the point of view of many results we believe in conformal field theories. That's right. Reni at 1/2 will be bigger, but perhaps from the area law divergent term. Okay, so that was one set of results that we have of trying to understand connections between families of conformal field theories and this quantity involving negativity. In my remaining 5 minutes, I will tell you about a completely different set of toy models involving systems with discrete degrees of freedom. So Max decided to get some feeling for this ratio, and in general negativity, by looking at pure states of few qubits. Let's say you pick your favorite set of some number of qubits. I'll pick 8 for now. And you do a cut, you sort of demarcate them into two groups. So this is a, so I you know the state, you know it's a, the state is pure. You pick some state out of eight qubits, out of the 2^8 Hilbert space. You partition them in some way across some fiducial cut. And then you can decide to compute various quantities for the reduced density matrices you induce under this partition. So we can choose to compute, let's say, the negativity of this pair relative to this pair, which you might want to call the negativity of two qubits in the first set relative to two qubits in the second set under the partition induced by this cut, which I've just called sigma. Or you can choose to do negativity of this pair with the single qubit here, which you might want to think of as some kind of local entanglement or negativity for this 1-2 partition given this reduced density matrix on 4 qubits. The picture is we will allow ourselves the pure state of many qubits. By tracing out a few, we will have reduced density matrices or mixtures for fewer qubits, and then we can play games with those few qubits. Okay, so I'll tell you one interesting set of results that we found in this context. So we tested this set of these qubit experiments against things we expect to see in holography. And had we had the entropy cone paper at that point when we did the experiment, we might have tested a few more things. But the kinds of tests we did were we were trying to look for when is monogamy of mutual information, which we've heard about, respected. So when is this quantity, which is for a set of three objects, when is I3 negative? So that was one test we ran. The other test we ran was to ask when is under what conditions is monogamy of n squared respected. So here I have to explain to you what this is. So one useful result that transpires to hold for the negativity, or rather the square of negativity, is that the square of negativity satisfies the following monogamy relation. Which was proved by Giffre and his student a few years ago,
numerically.
And the reason why we were interested in this is that in holography, it's possible one finds situations where the Araki-Leib inequality is saturated. And let me remind you that the Araki-Leib inequality says that okay. And we were wondering, so if this monogamy of negativity squared is saturated, you can argue that the degrees of freedom in one of these components, B, factorizes into stuff that's purely entangled with A and those that are purely entangled with C, which is roughly the intuition you get when the Araki-Leib inequality is saturated. So we were wondering whether these two, there's some correlation between these two, and whether we could see that in this qubit states. And rather than describe to you a whole host of results, let me tell you that the set of experiments we did tell us that in general, monogamy violation, monogamy of MMI, happens for states with low robustness, and large multipartite entanglement,
positive,
Sorry, yes, yes, this is non-holographic, yes. So we sort of know this because the GHZ type state, we know violates monogamy of mutual information. But in the space of states, states which have high degree of multi-partite entanglement, and to sort of measure this multi-partite entanglement, we use the tangles, they seem to satisfy this. And there's a correlation between this low robustness and also with this saturation of Arakis leaf. So the class of experiments we did also involved trying to do specific things for few qubit systems based on various classification schemes that people have, which you can ask me about. But the picture, the general picture, which this qubit experiment suggests to us is the following, which is something that partly, I think, addresses one of the questions I tried raising at the beginning, is that holography seems to care about two-party entanglement more, at least if you use very naive set of criteria from coming from geometric considerations involving things like Arakis-Leib or monogamy of mutual information. Bipartite, robust bipartite entanglement seems closer to holographic systems than multi-party entanglement. So that's the, if you like, a one sentence summary of this investigation. And Frank is indicating that I should stop. So with that moral of the story, let me conclude. But before I end, I think it's time for us to thank Mark, Rob, and Giffrey for putting together such a fantastic workshop. It's been great to be around this week. So I think we should give them all a very big hand.
Questions to Mukund or the organizers?
When are you doing the next one?
We should have three.
Yes. So is it correct for me to think about these experiments that you did as, in some sense, a coarse grained answer to the question that Adam asked me during my talk, which is the relative volume between the quantum cone and the holographic cone?
Perhaps, yes. I haven't thought about it in those terms, but that sounds about right. So, I should be a bit more careful, because for few qubits, we can do, for 3 and 4 qubits, you can do much better. When you even ramp up to 6 or 8 qubits, yes, we need some random sampling in the space of pure sets. And while we can make a class of genericity type statements based on random sampling, you can clearly, of course, write down states that would do various things that if you want to violate any of these things. So to get good measures, I think if we can develop a a good statistical theory of these things, I think you would get an answer to your question much more cleanly. And I think such a construction should be very easy to do. Just thinking of how to interpret ensembles of pure states and doing, writing down probabilities of various of these quantities under various partitionings, that should be very straightforward. Some people have actually tried doing some such thing for qubit sets. They were interested in things that actually are close to something you might like in holography. There's a class of states that people try to construct statistically which have maximum two-party, three-party, four-party entanglement under various cuts. And they did this precisely by trying to develop a statistical methodology. And for four qubit states, you get a very interesting state that looks like what you might want to call maximally scrambled. So it has the least value of I3, although they were not trying to minimize I3 in the space of four qubits.
more questions. Okay, let's thank the organizer for this wonderful work.